Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Cereal from the Box.
I'm Marie.
I'm Gianna, and this is the podcast where we do self-exploration. You get over or overcome your fears surrounding food in your body, and you make new friends and have a great time. Whoop!
Yes, we love it. And today we are back with yet another guest. Today we have Tori, who is the first roommate I've ever had besides my family, and was one of the best roommates I've ever had. I'm pretty sure I've talked about you on the podcast before, Tori, and I give you like all the credit for starting off my recovery journey. So I am super happy that you're here.
And I'm happy to meet you.
Yes, I'm happy to meet you too, Gianna, and I'm so happy that you all have me here. I'm excited that we're having this conversation.
Yes, definitely. So just a preview for you all. Today we're going to talk about co-occurring mental illness, specifically eating disorders with other mental illnesses. But before we kind of jump into that topic, I wanted to give you a chance, Tori, to kind of talk about what your experiences with your body, with food, what that's kind of looked like for you. And then we can kind of jump into the other stuff.
My name is Tori. Hey, everyone. And I guess where I'll start was honestly, even in elementary school, just with what I knew about eating, what I knew about food options, what I knew about self-esteem, and all of that was very little. It was not talked about, even in health classes. It was very straightforward. You saw the plate. Memorized the plate, you took the quiz, and that was really it. And all of that really left a lot of questions. And when you start transitioning into being a teenager, it leads to a lot of feelings. And I ended up just having a lot of feelings and not knowing really where I could go to get those questions answered. And for me, I kind of just turned inwardly. And I started really internalizing these feelings and not really knowing how to get them out or which behaviors will really correspond to how I was feeling in the right way, not knowing that I could just talk about it because these things around body image, they were also pretty taboo topics to talk about. And so that kind of in middle school, that's when the bullying came in. I was a pretty chubby little kid. I was cute, but I didn't feel cute at the time. I just felt chubby. So with the bullying came in and the comments about the weight, that's when, the self-consciousness came in. And so those mix of emotions, not knowing what to do with them, they kind of bubbled over. And I can remember times where I didn't know they were panic attacks, but I was having panic attacks pretty regularly at home, even at school, especially. And that's really when I started having those disordered eating behaviors. It was as a response to those panic attacks. I remember just leaving, I would be in a cafeteria and I would just feel like everyone was staring at me. And, I would feel so self-conscious in my body, like so uncomfortable under my skin that I would, run out and there's not many places to go in school where they won't tell you to go back to where you're supposed to be, except for the bathroom. So I found myself alone in the bathroom with all these thoughts and all these feelings. And so I honestly started with the purging behaviors, just, wanting to get things out. Well, not knowing what I wanted to get out, but knowing that I just had to get something out and not knowing that it would spiral, not knowing that this was disordered eating. That's really where it started. And for me, because I wasn't talking about it, it became a habit pretty quickly, pretty quickly. And I also grew up in a very strict and sheltered household where I didn't have control over what I ate. Whatever was made that day for dinner, put on your plate, you're eating all of it and you're not, getting up until you finish all your food. So I didn't have really that autonomy over what went into my body. So I felt like the only control that I had was what came out of my body. And that continued as I entered high school. And that's when I gained a little bit more freedom with what I did or didn't eat. But since these things had, they were spiraling at that point, just getting worse, I was still having the panic attacks. I was going through long periods of depression. I was in a very unhealthy, toxic relationship throughout high school. So all of these things were really compounding on top of each other. And when I was given the option of, you know, not eating breakfast in the morning because I was rushing for school, that's what I did. I skipped meals. And I told myself I was too busy or I wasn't hungry, just convincing myself, whatever I had to tell myself, to make it okay, not knowing that, you know, it wasn't okay and I needed to talk to somebody. I just, that had never crossed my mind. That's not something that my family has said. If you need help or if you're going through something, you don't know what's going on, just talk to somebody. So it was a lot of that compounding. And it just got to a point where it did take a toll on my body. Like I didn't notice any weight loss or anything. I thought I looked the same. If anything, I thought I was looking worse because at that point I couldn't see. I couldn't see what was in the mirror, you know? It was not a true reflection of reality. It was a reflection of all the thoughts and feelings that I had since I was, you know, since before I was a teenager, you know, all coming out in whatever behaviors I felt I could have control over at that time.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially when like kind of those behaviors started with this like internal emotional turmoil that was kind of going on because of all the things that you're experiencing, like it would make sense of like how that would have like a lot of undue influence on your perception of how you looked and things like that.
Yeah, it definitely did. And there were some social factors, like it's pretty normalized. So I'm a Black woman, y'all can't see me, but hey. And it was pretty normalized in my community for people to make comments about your weight. You know, they always commenting on a kid's weight. They say, you know, hey, you're looking healthy. that's their go-to. You're looking healthy. And that doesn't, you know, that sounds like such a good thing. Like healthy, we want to aim for healthy, but that was how they told you that you're looking a little, you know, round around the edges. So that kind of also distorts, you know, like, do I want to be healthy? Like, if that's how, the way that they're using it and things. So it kind of skews your perception when we don't have open conversations like that.
That's like Hispanic too. Like, be like, oh, like, esa rellenita, like you're looking like really like full. And that's like, you'd be like, oh, thank you. Like, is that a good thing? Like,
right,
that you're rounded out. I'm like, do I want to be rounded out? Like, I'm not sure I like that you're talking about me, but like, thank you.
Yeah. And there's always that like uncomfortable feeling of I don't want you to comment on my weight. I don't want you to comment on my appearance at all.
Please don't perceive me.
We're honestly like, close your eyes around me, maybe. And I feel like that comes up with like the boundaries that no one tells us we're allowed to have, that we are allowed to have from birth of, you can't just come and comment on your perception of me, you know, so unsolicited, and especially in a way that's like, that's negative. Like that's rude when you think about it. And it's rude when it happens.
Yeah. I had this like, I don't know if it was like an epiphany, but freshman year of college, I had this like very pervasive thought of like, I am not myself. I'm a reflection of how everyone else perceives me. And it really kind of fucked with me a little bit, you know what I mean? Just to like have to, I guess, be performing all the time in order to like curate your own self-image around other people.
Yeah, and we can get stuck like inside our own minds, but we can get stuck in other people's minds too. And it's never really what's in their minds. It's just us thinking so hard that like we're mind readers at that point. We're like, wow, I know how you see me, and I know I can change how you see me by doing this, this, and this, and acting this way, acting this way. And we can get really deep into it. And I was really deep into it too. And then until I came to a point where it's just like, okay, my mind is doing this. You know, I have like, it's part of my strengths, it's part of my abilities, how strong my mind is, but only if I use it for my benefit, you know, only if I use it to put me in a better place, not to harm myself. Like, I had to have that perspective shift for sure. And it took a while. It took a very long time. And of course, y'all know this is a journey, a lifelong journey for sure. So, but it's just about those little perspective shifts, in my opinion, those little bits of information that sit with you and just make you question, like, okay, is this behavior serving me? Is this thought serving me? Is this feeling serving me? I can still have it, but is it serving me in the way that I need it to right now?
So, like, when did you start to, like, shift your mindset towards this? Like, was this kind of when you started recovery, or is that those, like, are things that you've just begun to start thinking about? Like, what was from your lowest point, like, how, like, where and when, like, did things start to hopefully turn around for you?
So I'll give like a little bit of background with this too. So my undergraduate degree was in psychology, and I'm currently in a dual degree graduate program, getting my master's of social work degree and my master's of public health degree.
You all have to deal with two social workers on this podcast right now.
Right, it's going to get deep.
Exactly.
And one unemployed artist.
We love it. It balances out.
The balance, yes. And the talent, yes. So, and I feel like this ties into the theme of this episode too, with that my kind of treatment journey where I got my turning points started with me seeking mental health treatment. And for me, I think part of it was that mental health treatment was like a little bit more accepted than getting treatment for eating disorder, especially when I didn't have the language around it, when I didn't even really perceive my eating as disordered in any way at that time. But I knew that I had always had these emotions in me and this misunderstanding, even of myself, that that I wanted to deal with. So when I did go to college, I graduated, I was still having some difficulties, like, emotionally. And so not the first time, because I had some experiences with therapy in high school. And I got a few diagnoses here and there, like panic disorder and dysthymia. But none of them really, really fit. And my household was not really a medical treatment friendly household. There was a lot of stigma related to getting any kind of mental help. A lot of perceptions of what it will make the family look like if anyone knew that I was going through these issues. So I honestly tried to tough it out. Even when I started therapy, I stopped because I felt like it was a burden on my family. And not really recognizing, like, I still needed some assistance at that time. But when I got to college, fortunately, they offered some free counseling sessions. And one thing that's, it's been rocky, but also kind of helpful, is that I've bounced around a lot. So I've got referred around to different places. Like, when I went to that free counseling session, they recommended me to a psychiatrist. And when I went to the psychiatrist, I told her about, you know, all of the things that was going on. That was the first time that we talked about my eating habits and my eating behaviors. And that's when I received a diagnosis for my eating. And like that instantly was like, that was the first shift, because no one had told me. Like, it's not like I had felt good. Like, there was definitely feelings of shame at my lowest point, but there was also not the understanding that this is something that people go through. There are treatment options for it. Like, it's a real thing, you know, that you can handle and deal with. So that was the first point where that happened, which allowed for that perspective shift, I would say. And that was from a mental health professional. So I think that they were very tied to each other, and she recommended a nutritionist. But at that time, they didn't offer free sessions with your nutritionist, only free mental health counseling sessions. And I needed those free services. I had insurance issues at that time. I was a student, kind of dependent, you know, but under my parents in certain ways. And so it was really hard navigating that system, because even when those free sessions ended, I found myself kind of back at square one, not having a mental health professional, not knowing really where to go, having just told my story and my issues, basically laid it all out for a person, and then knowing I'd have to do it all over again. It was, it's very stressful, but I feel like that also gave me perspective, because at that point I knew I had to make a change, and I knew that it may not be through a traditional route, like a traditional treatment route. And it also made me realize that I was not the only one going through those issues. It made me think back to high school of my friends who had showed similar, you know, behaviors that I did, but we never really talked about it. And we may have made little jokes here and there, you know, to laugh through the pain, but we didn't take it seriously. And not that it was, you know, at all our faults, but you just look back and you realize that, you know, there are other people who may be able to get treatment, may not be able to get treatment, but the need is there. And that kind of has led me to the work I want to use my degrees for, but it's also been very useful in my own journey.
Yeah, that definitely resonates, especially when you're kind of talking about like that other mental health struggles tend to be more validated, and you can kind of enter into a treatment kind of setting quicker than you can with eating disorders. And I'm even like thinking for myself, and I had a very skewed perception at the time, obviously, about like how my eating habits were and like to what extent they were disordered. But I think honestly, like it was really like my mood and like the level of anxiety, I guess, that I was kind of like experiencing as a result of the eating mm-hmm. disorder that sought me to seek out help. And it just so happened that like I had the resources to get into treatment and like have that be an accessible option for me when it's not accessible for a lot of other people.
Yes, access is, that's like one of my favorite words right now is accessibility. Like that's what I want to strive for in the healthcare system, not just the mental health care system, but across the board, because it really is all connected. Like some medical professionals, they don't screen for these things, like even just disordered eating, even though it goes into our physical health so clearly. And not even all mental health professionals screen for these kind of things, but we know how pervasive it is. And one approach I really take when thinking about these things is like everything it's on a dimension. You know, I feel like everyone fits on it somewhere, where they've had struggles, maybe with food, maybe with their self-esteem, somewhere along the way, you know, how they felt about certain things affected their behavior, and they may not have known or had the information or been empowered to make the best decision for their health. So I feel like these things, not that we need to normalize the issue, but we need to normalize talking about it. And being able to offer information in a way that like reduces stigma. And I feel like by honestly just being open about it. And in previous episodes, you all have talked about how even people think that eating disorders look one way. And part, a big part of that is in schools, but another part of that is in media, even treatment centers, when they have their ads, who are they showing as their clientele?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like it's all the same population. So people say, if I don't look like that, then I can't be there. I can't get treatment here. This place is not for me, you know? And that is, and that's how a lot of people feel. And I know that even I've talked to my friends and, like we said, we didn't think anything was wrong because we didn't fit the look, and you know, the look that mm-hmm. we saw. And now I know that there is no look, you know, like I never hit a certain weight, but it was how it was impacting my body. Like there were points where I was sick for a year straight, just with different cold after cold after cold, because my immune system, it needed the energy and it wasn't getting it. You know, I was depleting my immune system and wondering why I can't get rid of this cold, why I'm always coughing and sneezing and things. So it's I feel like we got to shift it from being about appearance to more about wellness, you know, in the health and
right.
life quality.
Like when I was like being not so good, I was like always injured. I was like, why do I have two sprained ankles at the same time? Like, like I wonder why I'm in a lot of physical pain all the time. It's like, oh, maybe because you are not eating and then you're trying to do some exercise. Sounds like a very bad idea.
Yeah, and it's sneaky, and it's so sneaky because these are the little decisions that we make every single day. You know, every single day you decide, you know, if you're hungry, then you know you'll get food. But it's the thing that we expect that people eat every day, but that's not easy for everybody. You know, it's like we also have to shift our expectations that we have on people. And if we are not offering people the support to make choices for their body and to eat when they're hungry. Like, I'm a big supporter of intuitive eating. I know you all are too.
Yes.
But if we're not giving people the tools to know how to check in with their bodies and to trust their bodies, which has been like the biggest part of my journey, is learning how to trust myself again and believe myself and what I feel, then we can't place the expectation on people not to have certain behaviors and eating patterns that may not be the best for them.
That's like something that I really want to see happen, especially like, even though for, I don't know about you guys, like your parents, but I feel like my parents are like, they just struggle so much with like listening to themselves. Like they are like blame themselves. Like, oh, I'm like, this food is so bad for me. And like, this food is like, this is why I look like this. And it's like, well, if you just listen to your body, like you won't have all these feelings about it. Like, cause you'll just know like, this is the way it's supposed to be. Like you eat the things that you want to eat. And they just have such a problem with that. And I don't know. I don't want to say that it's like too late for them, cause I really hope it's not, but I'm like, how do you re-educate people about being nice to themselves? Like, I feel like they don't want to.
Yeah.
No, I understand completely.
And like concurrently, I was just kind of thinking about this in joint with like what you've already been sharing about like your personal experience, Tori, is how not only are we not in tune with our bodies in order to register hunger and fullness cues, but a lot of us aren't in tune with our bodies emotionally either. Mm-hmm. And we don't validate our emotional experiences and things like that. So to have eating disorders, which a lot of times are rooted in that kind of inner emotional turmoil and things like that, and to not be able to validate yourself, show compassion for yourself, like that makes it a lot harder when you don't trust your body on a physical level, but also on that mental, emotional level to kind of work towards that recovery, that intuitive eating and things like that.
Yes, definitely. And I feel like that's where like the community you're in comes into play too, because if you're raised in a community where, you know, food is scarce, then, and you have a disordered eating, like I didn't grow up in the richest family whatsoever, then you're looked at as ungrateful, you know, and that adds a different layer on top of the struggles you're already dealing with, you know, knowing that you don't want to eat this, but you should, but you can't, but you, it's like, it just go back and forth and back and forth. So when you add race on top of that, you know, and socioeconomic status, it becomes so layered and so deeply entrenched that you think that it's a part of who you are, and your behavior, it kind of becomes a big part of your identity. And I feel like that's a hard part to separate on when you're trying to recover, is trying to reclaim your identity. But that's also been some of the funnest part, I can say for sure.
Yeah, scary sometimes, but also like definitely exciting to kind of discover yourself. Has there been ways that you've been doing that to kind of get to know yourself again?
Yeah, so I got myself a shadow workbook. And that has been an experience. I think I showed it to you.
Yes, you did tell me about it. That's why I'm making a face right now.
I did, and it gets intense. It definitely gets intense, but it's all you, you know, and it's you talking to you, the parts of you that you don't want to talk to or acknowledge or don't feel the best about. And and saying, like, it's self-validating, you know? So it's, for me, it's saying, you know, I see myself. I see the parts of myself that I don't want anyone, that I don't want to show anyone. And it's okay. Like, it's okay because I can move forward. I can move past that. And I feel like I'm in a great position where I'm able to integrate this into, like, my future work as a social worker, and even the programs I'm doing now as an intern, where I'm creating mindfulness programs for kids, elementary, middle schoolers, also young adults, you know? And because if we don't get these things when we're younger, it's never too late. We can understand them and learn them as adults. We can always practice mindfulness. I don't meditate every day. I don't do yoga every day, but I am a strong advocate for mindfulness because for me, it's just doing a quick body scan with myself, me saying, hey, how are you doing, Tori? You know, how are you feeling? Is there any feeling in your stomach, even if it's not a hunger, you know, but is there, you know, is your back hurt, you know? And just being able to just listen to yourself for like a few seconds, ask yourself a quick question. We ask our friends, you know, how are you doing? You know, we ask our family members, you know, hey, what's up? So just ask yourself every now and then, hey, what's up? And listen, you know?
That's a really good point, because I feel like, you know, the commercialization of, like, wellness, like, oh, like, you have to go to yoga and Pilates. And, like, mm-hmm. like, obviously, you know, even, like, from my background, like, I would be like, oh, that's for rich people. Like, do you think my mom was doing yoga? Absolutely not. Like, that was for, like, rich white people, yoga, even though that's even taken from, like, a different culture. You know, that's not even, but it's been commercialized so much that people feel like, oh, wellness isn't for me. That's like for those people. But like doing a body scan, like that's absolutely, you know, everyone can do that. And even like, oh, like my body can't do that. I physically am unable to do things like yoga, or I physically cannot eat those fancy foods, whatever. Like, I think that's really a good way to like put it. And I feel like it's good that you guys are like the future social workers, because like you will teach children to do this from a young age, and then maybe they'll be able to like analyze themselves and be like, oh, I guess there is something kind of like I should deal with at this point. And they won't wait until they're having children and then like spreading bad things to their children.
Yes, RT. I am raising a 3-year-old little boy. And my favorite thing right now that he does is when he gets a little frustrated, a little flustered, I say, take a deep breath in through your nose, out through your mouth. And he really does it.
I have seen. Yeah, I have seen so many TikToks about like either parents or classroom teachers that have taught their kids like emotional regulation skills. And they're so good at it. And yes, they'll do it. I love it. It's really great, actually.
Yeah, it warms my heart, because that's something I recently started doing, is just being able, like taking a step back, deep breath, you know? So for him to get that so young is like, yes, when we model for them, you know, more healthier alternatives, and, you know, we just talk to them, answer their questions, because even at 3, there's questions, there's a curiosity, then they grow up with these things are normal, you know, breathing in and out and emotional regulating yourself is the norm. It's what you do, because emotions are normal. Anger, to a certain extent, is normal. So, mm-hmm. you know, the response to it should also be normalized.
Very true. So I know we've talked in like past episodes, I think even just the last episode that we did, Gianna's talked a little bit about her ADHD diagnosis and how that's kind of intersected a little bit in terms of just like staying on top of her recovery and things like that. So I was wondering if you could kind of share a little bit more. I know you kind of touched on, you know, like the panic attacks and the depression and how that kind of coincided along with like some of the disordered eating patterns and things like that that you're experiencing. So I was just wondering if you wanted to kind of touch on that a bit more and like what intersections have you kind of noticed for yourself?
Yeah, so I received, while I was in undergraduate, I received the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And out of all the diagnoses, this one I felt fit the most. And most of that was that I felt like the treatment was the most aligned with what I thought I needed at the time. And so that was the one that I've kind of like stuck with along the way. And that's been the pretty consistent, even when I've navigated to different therapists and even social workers myself, that's like the commonality between it, well, between their diagnosis for me, I would say. So that definitely has some intersection with my eating. As you can imagine, like with bipolar, there's the highs and the lows. So with that, my appetite and my eating, the behaviors, the range is a very, very big range. So, but at the same time, like some days I won't have an appetite. And that instantly gets kind of scary for me. Like I instantly started thinking like, is this a relapse? Like, am I, you know, telling myself I'm not hungry? Am I ever going to want to eat again? You know, I start worrying myself, you know, and that also contributes to like the mood cycles and things like that. But I realized I had to stop like pathologizing myself and realizing that every time I'm not hungry, that's not a relapse, or even every time that I want to sleep all day, you know, that's not a depressive state. Every time I'm super productive, it's not a mania. Like it's good that I'm aware and keeping track, but every shift and everything that looks like could be something isn't that, because it's the intention behind it. You know, and that comes from that awareness. And once you have that intention behind it, like, well, do I want to feel this way? Obviously, this is a little bit distressing. I'm concerned that, you know, I haven't eaten today and I'm not feeling it. Like, you know, is there something I could do? How does a smoothie sound? You know, and I'm fortunate that I have a partner that loves to cook. Yes. and he loves to feed me. So he'll always check in and be like, are you hungry? You know, like he'll just come in and bring me a plate. And then if it's still sitting there, he'll, you know, be like, is everything all right? You know, so he gives me a lot of space to just like verbalize like, I'm having some concerns today or not. So, you know, I feel like all of that definitely comes into play.
I feel like my boyfriend is the same way. Like, he basically, like, watching him eat, like, taught me how to eat. Mm-hmm. And, like, maybe a little too much pasta because he loves pasta. So, like, you know, right now, and, like, a part of ADHD is, like, eating a lot of the same foods over and over and over. Mm-hmm. I'm in a pasta state right now. Give me a few weeks, it might be rice. It was rice at the beginning of the fall, and now it's pasta. But, like,
love it.
So he's always like, oh, let's cook this. Let's cook, like, meat, let's cook things like that I kind of try like to stay away from. He's like, let's eat these things that like you never eat, but this is my favorite thing ever. And I'm like, okay, I cooking. Or he'll like, I bought a lot of spinach, take it home. I'm like, oh, but I don't eat spinach. Well, like, I guess if you're just giving it to me, I'll okay, thank you. Right.
Guess you do now.
Right. I have a bag of frozen spinach in my fridge right now. I put it in a smoothie. I was like, I am healthy. I am well. Yeah. I have nutrients.
The epitome.
Honestly, like, I just go in cycles where I don't eat, like, nutritionally dense foods. I just am, like, that's eating solid. The same things. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, nice to be with somebody who's, like, very – he's like, oh, well, we had pasta for 4 days in a row. Let's have some salad today. Let's eat something with vegetables in it. I'm like, vegetables. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Let's do that.
Yeah. Wait, there was something else, Tori, that you said that resonated with me. I think it was about like the awareness and how like not over pathologizing yourself, mm-hmm. which I think is really interesting, because I think a lot of times, like, once you get a diagnosis, like, in a way, it can be like a little bit of a safety net. And I've noticed for myself, like, this hyper awareness, especially like around meal times and things like that, mm-hmm. in terms of like, okay, am I having enough? Am I choosing this option, you know, out of taste preferences, or is it related to something else? And then like kind of always double checking myself that way. And same thing with like my depression, which like honestly like I haven't had like a depressive episode in, I don't know, I guess probably like a year or something like that, I would say, which I know, like, good. But then at the same time, like, but wait, I'm supposed to be depressed, like, but I'm not. Or like, I'll have one off day and I'll be like, oh my God, what's happening? Am I going to enter a depressive episode? Who knows? So it's like very, it's just a weird and kind of surreal experience, I think, sometimes when like, your identity becomes too aligned sometimes with like the diagnoses that you're given. And I think that can kind of like what you were saying, like that over awareness can maybe not be as beneficial.
I feel like I kind of had the opposite, like, cause then like when I got diagnosed with ADHD, they're like, okay, here's this like medicine. And then like, I did a lot of research like on things that could help me. So I feel like now when I am doing a behavior, I'm like, oh, this is okay. You could like just, okay, focus and then don't do it. And like, for me, it's been really helpful to like know that it's not just me and my personality. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I just like to laze about. Like, no, it's like, okay, you're a little bit overwhelmed and this is because of this, but you don't have to be overwhelmed. Like, you can keep going forward with it. So I feel like for me, it's actually the opposite. Like, being aware of the behavior makes it like better for me. I don't know.
I think that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up because that reminded me to bring up the fact that for my mental illness, I don't take medication for it. And I feel like that also helps with like, you know, symptom management, honestly. So I found, or I'm in the process of still finding other ways of managing how I feel. And my main reason for, you know, choosing this method of treatment is that I realized that for me, and unfortunately a lot of Black women, most of our emotional, I'm doing quotes right now, issues come from trauma. They come from things that have happened to us and environments that were harmful to us. And those things cannot be, you know, medication doesn't fix those things. Now, they can help symptoms, and I'm not, you know, an anti-medication person, but I definitely think that identifying the root cause should be a priority in treatment. And that for me is, you know, why I kind of had to find more other creative ways of managing, you know, how my moods. And one of those for me was transitioning to being vegan. So sorry, Deanna, I know it's 2-1 social workers.
True vegans, yes.
You know what? The thing is, if it wasn't like triggering for me, I totally would also, because I feel like,
yeah, ethically, that's valid.
Ethically, it's completely a great valid choice, and like environmentally also like a great choice, but just like for my mental health, unfortunately right now I don't think it's a good idea. And like, mm-hmm. just because also this is kind of a bad reason, but like that's like a really big bonding thing for me, is like eating what other people eat that makes me feel good. Like having to eat a whole different meal would like make me feel like really terrible, and like I'm so make people complicated. So like for me it wouldn't work out, but like I fully support the vegan ethical movement. Like, go you guys. Okay.
Yeah. And we support, you know, people that have to make a similar choice to you, Gianna, and yes, like realize completely. That veganism is not productive to their recovery, and that's totally okay too.
Yes, I agree. And I feel like I can honestly say I couldn't have done it without my boyfriend, because we went vegan on the same day as each other, like, you know, so I've had that support there. And like you said, Gianna, just with, you know, any kind of food, we've been trying so many different things. Like, so for him, everything that he ate before he went vegan, he wants the vegan version of it. And he's going to make the vegan version of it, no matter what is in the way or what we have in the kitchen, he's going to make it. And it's going to be really good. But just having those options has helped me a lot, because it doesn't feel like I'm missing out on anything. And I can definitely understand the bonding part of it too, because it gets awkward when I go, well, when I used to go home for holidays pre-pandemic, but and eating with my family, then they would have meat, you know, and dairy and everything. And it was a little awkward, them saying, you sure you don't want to eat this? You love this. You used to, you know, eat like 5 plates. And I'm just like, no, thank you. Like, you know, I've made some changes for myself and things. So, but I feel like it has contributed, more positively to my mental health. And it's different for every one. And it's different for me, you know, sometimes from day to day is not the easiest thing because it's very inaccessible. Being vegan is very inaccessible.
Yeah.
But it for me, it gave me a sense of healthy control in a way, and not so much over what I ate, but just having the knowledge of what is in the food and being able to make maybe more intentional choices than I did when I was, you know, just going out and getting whatever was available, which normally was either meat or, you know, dairy product.
Yeah. And I think too, like, being able to work in line with your values, you know, if like veganism is something that aligns with your values, the autonomy to choose to kind of show up in that way and make those intentional decisions in your life. I think that can also be like another beneficial aspect when it kind of comes back to that like identity conversation that we were having earlier.
I agree completely, completely, completely. So I would definitely say that's just one way that I feel like I have shifted maybe my lifestyle just to one that would allow maybe my emotions and my behaviors with eating to kind of just like be friends. You know, like fruits make me feel good, you know, so eating fruits make me feel good, and just, you know, the food that we make, and it makes me feel good. Like me and my boyfriend are starting a vegan business, making vegan food. And so, you know, that makes me feel good. All those things contribute, but they also promote just, you know, more food options aligned with what we want and what we need, you know, like saying you don't have to choose. You don't have to, you know, choose between eating good food or not even good food, but like food that tastes good, you know, is pleasing to you, and food that, you know, is more aligned with the choices you want to make and your values, like you said, Elsa.
That's so exciting. Congratulations on your new business.
Thank you. It's like old and new. We're kind of just kicking it up now. We've been around for a little while, but it's like now we're like, okay, let's do this thing.
So is it like catering? Is it like packaged food or like a meal service? Like what is it?
So we kind of do it all. We have a delivery service. We do same day delivery. You can order ahead. We also cater events. Like we've catered birthday parties. We can cater a monthly DC cleanup, like a community cleanup event.
That's fun.
I love those. They're great. Especially the weather's getting nice now. They're still socially distant. It's a way to give back and, you know, be environmental, all around great experience.
That's
so
awesome.
We do those. We started meal plans recently. So yeah, I'll plug my info at the end, and that's just another way of like, I don't know, regaining that control, but also regaining my identity, you know, kind of those things we talked about before. They all have been fitting into the decisions I've been making, like with my degree and in my relationship and regarding my mental health. So for me, it's becoming more authentic. You know, I want to show up as myself and who I know I am in every space, whether I'm alone and in front of a plate or whether I'm with my friends or whether I'm, you know, with a client. I want to be the most authentic version of myself. And I feel like to do that, I have to try to take the best care of myself as I can.
Yeah. And I'm even thinking maybe for a future podcast episode, it would be nice to really focus in on that concept of like control, since we know that like plays such a huge part in a lot of eating disorder behaviors. And there's other ways to kind of find that control in your life that doesn't always necessarily revolve around food and like trying to control your body and how you look and things like that.
Yes. A big key one that I've been like heavy on this year has been redefining things for yourself. So redefine hunger for yourself. Like you give yourself that definition of what that feels like for you, what that means for you, you know? And that's part of doing the body scans too, of going through and saying, when I am hungry, it feels like this, and this is what's going to happen, and defining that for yourself, and also defining things like productivity. You know, what does it mean to be productive? Naps are productive, you know? So it's like, it's about, you know, how we choose to see these things and knowing that we have the power to choose how we see things and, you know, what they mean for us.
That's super powerful. I love that. Especially because like using like hunger scales and fullness scales and things like that, for some people it just like doesn't really make sense to do that.
Arbitrary.
Yeah, like it can feel kind of arbitrary of like, what's really the difference between a 3 and a 4 in terms of like if you're on the hunger side and things like that. And also when you have hunger cues that aren't directly related to like how your stomach is feeling, you know, right. like a gurgling, whatever, making growling noises, like that isn't always what hunger looks like. Hunger can look a lot of different ways. So really being in tune with that is definitely helpful to kind of define for yourself, for sure. And one other thing I kind of wanted to ask, going back to like, you know, the bipolar diagnosis that you had, you talked about like your appetite being affected. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a difference when you've been manic in like how that impacts food at all, if it does?
Yeah, so it's a little indirect, but I feel like those periods definitely make me question like that sense of control. Mm-hmm. And they make me like kind of mistrust myself, you know, because when I have all that energy and all those emotions back and forth, and it's like, to a certain extent now I know, you know, I kind of know when something's up.
Yeah.
So it's just like, and sometimes I want, you know, I have cravings, you know, and it's just like, I want to order a cake, you know, like, so I'm gonna order this vegan cake and I might eat it all, you know, and it's just like, with that, I've had to just give myself grace. But I notice those times, and I try not to, especially as a social worker, I try not to be like, oh, well, this is my manic episode impacting my, you know, ednos,
sure.
you know, behaviors.
Right.
And maybe I should try, you know, so I try to be a little less clinical about it and a lot less judgmental about it, but still aware. It's like, it's kind of like finding that balance. Like you said before, of like knowing what's going on, but not placing like any kind of negativity on it.
Being curious.
Right, right. Approaching it with like an open, gentle, loving curiosity, you know? You're like, you know, because it's just one cake. I know it sounds crazy sometimes. And it's just like, and that's the thing, like one day you're like, oh, it's just a cake. And then the next day you're like, it's just a cake.
Yes, like, yeah.
You know, but it's like, it's allowing yourself to have those different days. Like, I know you guys can't see me, but I'm wearing a pendant right now, and it has the Delta symbol on it, which represents change. And I wear this one the most.
It.
Yeah. And for me, it's like just accepting that change, accepting that tomorrow may be different from today, but I'm going to give myself that grace as much as I remember how to in that time. And I hope I'm not making it sound too easy, because it's not. It's
yeah.
not. Like I can say these words, and I hope they, you know, hit you all's ears, but at the same time know that it's not an overnight thing. And it really comes when you sit with yourself and you're able to tell yourself that it's okay. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to make the same mistakes. Because, you know, like you gotta tell yourself, I love you. You know, and like, I'm here for you, you know, and just starting there with yourself can make a big difference.
Yeah.
Do you feel like I feel like you probably have, because I didn't know you before, but I feel like in describing your journey, like you've like grown as a person and changed and are like on your way to like discovering your best you and like living your life. And like, since having all these discoveries and like feelings and changes, do you feel like your family has like opened up about mental health, or are they just still kind of stay plateaued in how they were before?
They've definitely opened up. I asked them straight up, you know, questions. Like my sister, she just had a baby. She gave me a niece. I'm so happy. And right after she had the baby, I asked her, okay, how are you feeling? Have you been feeling down? Have you been feeling more tired than usual? Like, tell me how your mental health has been, you know, since like having this baby, you know, we're going to talk about it. And if you don't have the words, that's okay, because I have an emotions wheel right here, and you can just point, you know, but, you know, I'm not going to accept that, like, oh, I'm okay, you know, or I'm fine, because we're all okay and we're all fine until we're not, you know, and it's just like, you know, she can choose not to tell me, but I'm just going to give her that space. And that's what it's been about for me and helping my family open up about these kind of topics, is giving them the space. And it's still been hard because I still haven't really openly even talked to my family about my eating and my diagnosis. And so, you know, it's been brought up, you know, when I was a teenager, my mom made comments and asked questions, you know, but, you know, how she asked those questions wasn't in a way where I wanted to tell her the truth, you know. So she kind of asked things like, you know, are you making yourself throw up, girl? Like, what?
Oh, yeah, that's like, not, you know, guilt-inducing, shame-inducing, like, at all.
Girl, you look bony. You know, that's how she asked, are you, girl, look bony, you know? And so I'm like, of course not, mom.
What are you talking about?
Right.
It's fine.
Right. So it's just like there wasn't that space. And it came from her maybe not knowing how to approach the situation, and also that concern of like not wanting to really know the answer and not being ready to know the answer. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, how we ask. But to get back to your question, there is my train of thought. And it just left the station.
That's okay. Happens to me every episode.
I feel like because like when my sister was like diagnosed with like a eating disorder, and like then when I talked to my parents about ADHD stuff, and then like all of a sudden my mom is like, well, I told my doctor that like you have this. And then he was like, well, what do you think? And then I was like, well, I think I do a lot of the same things. It's like kind of caused them to be introspective about like, oh, well, we did this and this affected how you guys grew up, or like, oh, I see that you're getting treated for something that I think I've had my whole life. And it's like things that they thought were like, oh, this is just me. But it's like you were saying earlier, like, it's not just me. It's like something that has happened to a lot of people. So like, it's, I don't know. Do you feel like your family has been able to be introspective knowing about like the things that are happening in your life, or just like you're more probing them more than they're self-probing?
It's definitely more of me probing, and I can understand why, because they have a lot going on, and this is something also I want to do. I want to start my own nonprofit, but they aren't able to prioritize their eating habits, even if they aren't having like disordered eating. They aren't able to think about and make choices that they want to about what food they are eating and how often they are able to eat, because they have certain limits, whether it's monetary limits or time limits or accessibility to food, you know, and, you know, whether all of those things at once, people aren't able to, you know, focus and have that time for introspection. And I feel like I can only imagine if, as compounded as things were for me before I got treatment, I'm sure it gets to a point where it may be too overwhelming to kind of crack open that can of worms. And and that's one thing I definitely want to emphasize with them, that it's never too late to kind of check back in and, you know, self-assess, you know, and it's never too late for introspection. You could do it as for any age, anybody. So I think that's a good point, but I definitely think there's more room for improvement. And I'm glad I'm in a position where I'm able to start having those conversations with them.
That's good. I feel like that's the one thing I've never seen, like, an elderly person go to therapy. And I feel like that's going to be, like, our generation is, like, people who know how to prioritize, like, mental health, or, like, prioritize your eating and like having a schedule, not letting it be just like an afterthought. And I feel like it's going to be like 90-year-olds at the therapist office, you know?
Yeah. And it's like a lot of people think that people who are elderly don't have eating disorders, but I am convinced that
I could tell you their names, but I won't, of elderly people who literally have eating disorders and are teaching their adult children about like how to have an eating disorder, you know? Sorry, just grinds my gears.
Yeah, it's not
when
talked
you're elderly,
about enough.
Like, you don't have to be vain. You're 90 years old, you know? it's okay. Just enjoy the food for the time you have left on this earth. Like, there's more important things to worry about than how your pants fit you. Ah! I'm done.
No, I understand. And I could only imagine how ingrained it must feel for them for it to continue and for it to maybe go so unnoticed at that point because of their age only, you know, and people feel like they can prioritize things for elderly people and say that, you know, maybe their eating habits, as long as they're eating enough to sustain themselves, that, you know, they have nothing to worry about. But it's like, are we asking them? You know, are we looking at their history and actually making sure that things are getting resolved, or are we just, you know, making it easier for us? But that's the care of the elders in our community and society, that I could go on about that one.
Yeah, I think this happens like every episode where like something comes up and we're like, we could spend 100 years just talking about this topic alone, for sure.
Yeah, so many things are missed, like culturally, and, you know, related to age, and even like everything. I feel like our assessments could do so much better. Again, like the dimensional scale, and just asking people to tell their story instead of just being like, do you check this box and have you done this? And like, we are limiting our ability to help people, you know, just by the questions we ask in order to get them help or not. I'll stop there.
Yeah, you're so right though. But this is the perspective of two social workers who have a lot of time to think about these kinds of things. But I mean, even if we have the time to think about these things, it still affects people on the daily. So it's not like people are unaware of it. It's not like we live in this vacuum where we don't understand how like our society and communities impact like what we're experiencing on an individual level.
That's what I think about in my spare time, like all the things wrong with society. Right. And if there's any way I can help fix it.
True.
Fun.
I feel like I try to do like kind of on a micro scale of that, like with my students, because it's like most of what I feel like impacted my eating behaviors and like eventually like my negative behaviors was like being in this dance world where like, or like in this entertainment field where like everyone is had expected to be looking a certain way, and just like encouraging my students that they're fine, like the way they are and like the way that they've been made and are living. And like, if they want to change their eating habits because they feel like they need more nutrients or like whatever, that's one thing, but they shouldn't be changing their eating habits to change their body shape. And I feel like if I had received those messages from a teacher, even like from my health teacher, you know, like what message did I receive from my health teacher is to go use a very dangerous calorie counting app. But like if I had received like positive imaging about my body from a teacher it wasn't in a creepy way, I would have like probably maybe had a different life. I don't know. Like I like myself now, but like I could have had a bit of an easier time earlier.
I agree with you, and I think that also like starting a shift away from appearance and towards wellness could start early too, because we grow up thinking that our bodies are just to be looked at by other people and commented on, and we fail to realize that our bodies have thousands and thousands of functions and functions that we don't even know it's doing just to keep us functioning every day. And it's like we need that energy to function. So it's like we are ignoring the fact that we're essentially a machine and thinking that we are like an accessory, you know, and I feel like that focus on appearance makes us think we need to change at all instead of thinking we need to sustain ourselves, you know. And that kind of makes me think about this other little thing that I try to do. Like I try to find realistic ways of self-care and little mindfulness moments because life gets very hectic. So one thing that I started doing too is just like whenever I remember and I'm looking at the mirror, I try to just like thank one part of myself, you know, like I'll be like, thank you lungs for helping me breathe, you know, thanks skin, keeping all my muscles and organs in there, you know. It'd be really creepy without you, you know. Like, thank you, brain. You do a lot, you know. But like realizing that every part of ourself has a function, and it's not just to look good, you know. It's not just to be aesthetically pleasing. Like, we have a lot other things going on in what our bodies are functioning for.
Yeah, I like that too, because I think a lot of times, like, a lot of people are like, say positive affirmations to yourself. Tell yourself you're beautiful. Tell yourself you're going to have a hot girl summer and you're the hottest bitch alive and you're going to kill it.
That's hard and sometimes.
It's hard. And I feel like I see so many, you know, people just kind of adopt that that mindset, and it seems like their mindset just like shifts almost instantly. And I watch that and I'm like, I could never,
also,
you know,
like, realistically, I know that even if I am like hot bitch, hot girl summer, there will always be a hotter bitch to look up to. So right. Like, I might as well just be like, you're doing good for you.
Yeah.
You know, like you're saying, like, you're working, you work fine.
Yeah.
Thanks for being hot. Even though you might not be the hottest, you are hot, and thank you for doing that.
If you start sweating, just be like, oh, thanks for being hot, you know? Just, like, make it work for you.
Right. Yeah, I feel like the gratefulness and, like, showing your gratitude can be an easier place to start. And you kind of work your way up.
Yeah, like, it also applies to other things. So if you're grateful for you, then you can start to be grateful for everything else, and then people want to be around you because you're, like, not annoying about, you know. They'll be like, oh, she's so sweet, grateful, amazing. You know, then people want to be around you. You start with you. It spreads.
Yeah, that energy shift.
Yeah. Awesome. OMG, it's been like 1 hour. And I feel like, Tori, you could come back.
Yeah, we'll need a part two.
I'll come back.
I want to hear how your business is going next time, because it's going to be so exciting. Do you want to plug all your thingies? Oh, you make candles too, right? You're the person who makes candles. Okay.
I do. I have some dream projects. Yes.
Got one right here.
Showing off her candle. Yeah, I'll come back and I'll talk about the business more, and I'll talk about my nonprofit.
Oh my God, girl. You have so much going on.
All of our guests are really out here doing things, doing the most, and we love it.
Yes, but you can follow me on Instagram. It is Amori Tori, AMORE_TORI. My vegan food business is Eat Well, Know Wellin, which is EATWELLIN_NOWELLIN. Wellin means lion.
I didn't know that was you. Oh, that makes so much sense now. Are you in what area are you in? Like, metro area of which city? So people can, like, actually, you know, if they live near you.
Yeah, so we're serving the DMV area, specifically Baltimore, Prince George's County, and D.C. Can't forget D.C.
Amazing.
So thank you all for having me. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Like,
for
y'all know
coming.
I could talk forever. Thank y'all for listening. And this is super validating.
Yay. Well, guys, definitely look up Tori and all her fun, amazing stuff she's got going on. You can find us at Cereal from the Box on Instagram and email us at gmail.com, just our name. You can find me, Gianna Bartolini, on Instagram. I don't really have anything else, so that's just me, my face. And Marie/Elsa is private, so
don't
that's
get
a
that.
Bummer for everyone. And yeah, well, thanks, Tori. Thanks, Elsa. Yeah.
Take care,
Marie.
Everyone.
Bye.
Bye.